state operator map. I know this can be a very confusing subject, so please express all your potential confusions about this topic. The idea that in conformal field theories, there is a one-to-one correspondence between local operators and states on a circle. And actually, or on a sphere, this is just true in any dimension.
So it's sort of, so I know that the map is from like a cylinder to the sphere, right? But is the sphere the unique solution which treats zero and infinity symmetrically? Like, or are there some other spaces which treat zero and infinity symmetrically?
So, I think anything that kind of looks like I have a, so I put it like that. If you want something which has a space and a time and is conformally flat, I think pretty much you can always describe it as a sphere. S1 in our case, but S D minus 1 in general. So if you take a more general manifold, it will just not be conformally flat. So you will not be, the Hilbert space will not be describing local operators in flat space. It would represent local operators at the tip of a very complicated cone. So in conformal field theory, anything which is roughly conical allows you to talk about local operators at the tip of the cone. For example, in conformal field theory in some dimension, you might have your space-time, and you might have like a defect, like a line defect, which has a shape like that. You might ask yourself, okay, what are the local operators I can find at the tip of this conical defect? That's a thing. It has applications, for example, in studying the behavior of the scattering of high energy particles in some gauge theory. And you can study it using the state operator map by sort of surrounding it by a sphere and studying the states of the space, the space of states on the sphere with some defects. So the state operator map has a very wide range of applicability. But if you want to study operators in flat space, then you got to use just a sphere. Another observation which I feel it's interesting, perhaps not often remarked, is that if you have a generic quantum field theory, the space of local operators is a bit of a mess because it's very scheme dependent. You might even in a theory which is perturbatively free, even in perturbation theory, you try to write your local operators as polynomials in the field, say, and their derivatives. But you need to do some renormalization when you define them, because otherwise they'll make no sense. And the renormalization depends on choices of scheme, you know, how you decide to precise, what do you precisely decide to subtract from this operator? Like, it's always possible that your definition and my definition differ by subtracting the identity or something like that. Yes?
If you finished what you were saying, if not, you can continue. I just had a question about the amplitudes.
Yes.
You mentioned last time, for example, when we have, we can use the state operator correspondence to transform amplitudes in relations over spheres. But if we have, for example, loop orders, then it would be a torus or something.
Yes.
Is this map always unique to any order? Like, can we always make any scattering amplitude to a given manifold for a given loop order?
Yes. So it's a theorem that if any, well, I don't know what, sorry, how would I say this? If I have any surface which has a bunch of external legs, and anything going on in between, shape-wise. I can always pick a wild factor is just a function, right? I can just pick a function which is roughly one away from the tubes, and then goes to zero very fast as I go down the tubes. And it will always give me a surface which is almost identical to the previous one, but has now a bunch of points. And then there's the other theorem that the spatial complex structures of such a picture, including the position of the points, is a finite dimensional space that we can iterate over to define the amplitude. That's another theorem. This is the theorem of classical two-dimensional geometry, that up to wild transformations, there is a finite dimensional space of surfaces. Other questions before I comment more on state of the map? Okay, so the comment I was making is that, so in a general quantum field theory, the space of local operators has very little structure. It's a bit messy. But in a conformal field theory, because of the state operator map, this space has a lot of structure. This space is a Hilbert space. It's a nice inner product. It might be, in a conformal field theory, it's graded by energy, and so on. And so in conformal field theories, the space of local operators also has a lot of structure. It's a very nice space to talk about. So working in conformal field theory sort of get used to a lot of convenience in talking about local operators and correlation functions. And then a lot of that convenience get lost in general quantum field theory. Something rather bothersome, actually. Okay, so last lecture we reviewed some aspects of the state operator map for the free boson. Let me just review some CFT aspects. So I try to use as little CFT as possible in these lectures, but a little bit can be useful. So you can ask how operators transform under coordinate transformations. And, well, operators can transform in a lot of ways under coordinate transformations. There are special operators which are called primary operators. Which are labeled by two numbers and have the property that they transform. Let me try to say it properly. Yes. By powers of the Jacobian. So we encountered until now two examples of primary operators. We encountered del x, which has delta equal to 1 and delta bar equal to 0. And we encounter e to the ipx, which has delta equal to delta bar equal to p squared over 2. If your conformal field theory is particularly well behaved, primary operators are going to be the thing you care about the most. Now, under the state operator map, a primary operator maps to a state which has the following properties. Is killed by raising operators of the Virasoro stress tensor. And it has an energy. Well, up to Casimir energy. It has an L0. I'll discuss a bit more the relation between L0 and the energy again, just a moment. But has a specific eigenvalue of L0, which reproduces this scaling dimension, delta and delta bar. And now, for every so states which satisfy this property are called primary states. And that's sort of a basic ingredient when you talk about representation theory of the Virasoro algebra. Once you have a primary state, you can build other states by acting with with modes of the stress tensor. And these are called descendant states. And correspondingly, there will be descendant operators. You can convince yourself that the L minus 1 mode acts in a very intuitive way. For example, L minus 1 of a state maps to the derivative of the operator. L minus 2 is a little bit more complicated. It kind of wants to multiply you by the stress tensor. But of course, there is some kind of regularization involved. So describing these descendants as operators is a little bit of more of a pain, but it's very clear in terms of states. You ask a question? No. Okay, yes. And as you remember, we were discussing the spectrum of string theory in terms of descendants and primaries, right? We were saying kind of the constraints we wanted is that the states were satisfying some kind of primary property with delta equal to 1, and we're throwing away descendants. So if you map to this picture, now you'll have to talk about primary and descendant local operators instead of primary and descendant states. But the principle is the same. What are examples of operators or states which are not primaries? Well, of course, descendants. That's a bit silly. But let me give a couple of examples. So first of all, recall that the operator 1 goes to the state, to the ground state of your theory. I didn't define this for the ghosts yet. If you remember, I defined something called G instead of 0. There was a reason for that notation. I'll come back to that in a blackboard. For now, imagine this, we're talking about the X, the scalar fields. Then if I look at L minus 1 on 0, that's 0, because the derivative of 1 is 0. And L minus 2 on 0 gives me the stress tensor. So you can see kind of the stress tensor is not a primary. It's a descendant of the identity. And indeed, the stress tensor does not transform like that. So T of z equal the z prime over the z square T of z prime plus something called the Schwarzian derivative. Is it a 12 here? Yeah, I forget, sorry. Which is a horrendous expression involving third derivatives and second derivatives of z prime and with respect to z. And a particular example of this rule was that the stress tensor on the cylinder is related to the stress tensor on the plane up to a constant shift. Now, when we we introduce modes like the A's and the L's when we're working on the cylinder as a Fourier transform of fields. But in the definition, at some point, I was nicking some constant shifts. For example, when I defined L0, I did not define it as the zero mode of T. But rather, I said the zero mode of T is L0 minus 1 over 24. Right, the reason for that sneaky definition is that it turns out to be very natural to define the modes of operators on the plane rather than the cylinder. So if you have any operator O, you can define modes, sort of little O, and some expression like that. And of course, I'll never remember. Here there is a plus or a minus delta or something. I forgot to write it. So normally we define the modes of an operator by integrating them against e to the ns in the cylinder to do a Fourier transform. But it's a little bit more convenient to do a calculation in the plane and integrate them against z to the n. And so if you use this definition, say for t, when you expand out T of S, you'll get these constant shifts. So, for example, the definition of L0 I was using can be thought of as the integral of Z T of Z, the Z. Okay. So I just wanted to explain why I made some choices. Now, I did not discuss the state operator map for the Gauss yet, and I should do so. But before that, I want to recall another fact, which is useful to remember, that the Gauss number current, which we defined sort of as BC, is the current for a symmetry that gives charge 1 to C and minus 1 to B. So this one is also not a primary. Naively, it has dimension 1. But if you look at how it transforms using point splitting, there is an extra term involving the derivative, the logarithms of the Jacobian. This number here is either plus 3/2 or minus 3/2. And this corresponds to the fact that, again, the definition of the zero mode of the current versus the charge. If you try to measure the charge of a state, the Gauss number charge of a state, or the Gauss number of an operator, there will be a relative shift between the two. Which sort of is important to keep in mind when I write formula, when I write the state operator map for the Gausses. Because otherwise you'll see, oh, wait, this state does not have the singles number as the operator. So state operator map for the Gauss. So previously we defined this ground state G. There was also a C0G. Let me just work with holomorphic stuff, then we'll add the anti-holomorphic stuff later. And then there were also descendants, C minus 1 G, B minus 1 G, C minus 1 C0 G. B minus 1 C0 G. Etc. So, once I tell you where G goes, you can figure out where everything else goes just by the same technology used for the scalar field. But where does G go? How do I figure out that? So, one operator we definitely want to be able to talk about is the identity. And for the scalar field and other nice unitary theories, the identity always corresponds to the ground state. But the ghosts are not unitary, so this doesn't quite work. So see that in a unitary theory, one is this is the operator with the smallest scaling dimension. And so it can only go to the state with the smallest energy. But the ghosts are not a unitary theory. And so the state, and indeed, right, I should have said that. There are some operators which have scaling dimension which is negative. So I kind of wrote the scaling dimension of B and C in the previous lecture, but let me remind it. So B has scaling dimension 2, as it should be, because I want the BRST transformation of B to be the stress tensor. So they must have the same scaling dimension. On the other hand, C has scaling dimension minus 1. That kind of has to be the case because I want to do things like qx equal to c del x. So I want to c times the derivative to not to the scaling dimension 0. And so c ends up having scaling dimension minus 1. So in particular, it has a smaller scaling dimension than 1. How bad is this? What's the operator with the smallest scaling dimension you can write? Proposed candidates.
I cannot have too many c's because c squared to 0, right?
That's right. I cannot do c squared.
C dc.
Can do c dc. What's the scaling dimension of that? Minus 1. Can I go lower in any way? I mean, C, the square C is not going to help me. That's going to have scaling dimension 0. C del C, the square C, also will have scaling dimension 0. So I'm pretty much done. There are two operators with the smallest possible scaling dimension. They are C and C del C. So you can now perhaps guess that the ground state must be one of the two. And the total ghost number changes under the, in a specific way under the state operator map, but the relative one doesn't. So this has ghost number 1 greater than that. And this one has ghost number 1 greater than that. So the dictionary is pretty much fixed. I'm going to map the ground state to C. Conversely, how do I? Is there any way to transform C into 1?
I can integrate it against B.
Yes, I can use an OPE with B. So if I put a B near a C, I get 1 as the leading divergence. So I can just take a B of Z and act on this, then send Z to 0 and pick the same divergent part. And the result is that B minus 1 on the ground state is my identity. So I'll just name this the vacuum, not to be confused with the ground state. Just is a convenient name, just because if I use this name, it's a state that corresponds to the identity. And then conversely, this gets called C1 acting on the vacuum. See, has energy one lower than this vacuum. Just a naming convention. There is nothing very deep about this, but this state zero has a lot of nice features, right? L minus one kills it, etc. At the very least, it's the state which is natural when you do state operator map. But recall the G is the one that appears in the states, right? So whenever I do those calculations and I put G times something, I'll find an insertion on the sphere of C of Z, C bar of Z bar, and then an operator which corresponds to this physical state, by the state operator map. Okay. Now, are there any questions?
Mm-hmm. The way in which some operators fail to be primaries is always a shift. Like, is there a case in which, because here you said that it's important that the difference of ghost numbers is still going to be the same, like for
yes.
the two states. Like, is there another operator for which that is not true? Like, it transforms in a much worse way?
Yes. Right, not all operators have just a... Well, okay, every operator has a charge under J0, under the zero modulus, because number current. This you can diagonalize the zero modulus because number current. What could happen is that the positive modulus because number current might act non-trivially on some operators, even if tau they kill C and B. So there is definitely a notion of primary for a current. A primary for a current has a nice charge for the zero mode and is killed by the positive modulus of the current. Now, I want to write down sort of the simplest possible correlation function that we will need. And I want to derive it in two ways. So if you recall, I wrote an expression like that last time. Let's look at this expression a little bit. What does this imply on the... Well, okay, I will leave... Sorry. So what does it imply? Let's apply the state operator map on this formula. What do I get? I should be able to get a correlation function on a sphere out of this. Can we do it?
It's telling me that like C del C overlapped with C at infinity gives me...
Okay, so you're saying I have this G here, so I must have a C of zero, C bar of zero. And I have a G on the other side, so I must have a C of infinity, C bar of infinity. What about C zero?
It's like del C or something.
So C zero is just a mod of C of Z, right? If I look at C of 1, z is 1, meaning s is equal to 0. This is just sum of cn, right? But if I do not put c0 in here, I get 0. If I replace the 0 with a 1 or a 2 or a 3, they'll kill either this state or this state. So I could replace this c0 with c at 1. I wouldn't change anything. So this is the formula. Now, can you guess what happens if I change these points? What if I want to look at C of Z1, C bar of Z1 bar, C of Z2, C bar of Z2 bar, C of Z3, C bar of Z3 bar? How do I compute something like that?
Like C2 minus C3 squared or something.
So how would I systematically compute it?
Oh, but Z1 is not infinite, so like big con-
right, you're right. Things are not at infinity, so we should write a formula which involves 0 rather than a ghost number. So let me write that formula. I just use the definition of 0 in terms of ghost number, vice versa. So this is equal to 1. Okay, how do you use this formula to compute that?
I could use mode expansion, right?
Yes, I can go to this back to the cylinder. I have 0 and 0, and I have 3 insertions of C's and C bars. You can also mod expansion. Which terms of the mod expansion do I pick?
So there is like a relative Z between like neighboring insertions, something like that. Because I always have like C0, C1, or C-1, C0, so there is always like difference of 1Z.
Right, these modes have to be there. If I don't have C0, C1, or C-1, I'm dead. And if I have any other modes, they will kill 0 at infinity or in the past or in the future. So out of these, we have like 6 square terms. Because I can decide if C0 comes from here, here, or here, if C1 comes from here, here, or here, and if C-1 comes from here, here, and here. So it's going to be a polynomial in Z1, Z2, Z3, which has, you know, a bunch of terms. But there is a trick, which is these are fermions. If I exchange C of Z1 and C of Z2, I pick a sign. This polynomial has to be antisymmetric in any pair of variables. And so this kind of fixes it. And when I say this, I mean I'm exchanging only the holomorphic ones, not the anti-holomorphic ones. Right? This correlation function factors and a correlation function for the C's and one for the C bars. I'm just writing them both now because this is what we'll use in correlation in calculations. Okay, so there is this quantity which we'll need. Okay, this is a 3-point function. So this computes this sort of amplitude with a ground state at each leg. I would also like to remember another calculation which you didn't quite do. So it's not fair to ask you for to ask you to remember it, but we kind of sketched it. How to do calculations with the exponentials. We said we can just take weak contractions, making sure not to take weak contractions between an operator and itself. There is a bit of tedious combinatorics in doing so. There are shortcuts you can use. You can sort of move this to the action, for example. Treat this as a source for x. Look for a classical solution with that source. There are a bunch of tricks. We could go over them if you want. Perhaps it will happen in tutorial. I don't know. But let me just write the answer for now. The point is that these weak contractions sort of exponentiate. You get a sum, but this sum is really an exponential of a logarithm. And so you really get a product of things. I'm writing it for 3 points, but it's easy to generalize it. You get a factor for each pair of vertex operators. So what I was hoping to do is to sort of compute a tree, a vertex, where I put three of the simplest possible string states, three tachyons, three of the string states which come from the ground state in each given momentum sector. If you remember, the on-shell condition, the condition for these ones to be physical, was that the momenta square to chu. So I would like to sort of do a sanity check. I'm doing this calculation on this geometry. I'm by mapping it to a sphere with 3 points. The location of the points I leave arbitrary for now. But we know that there is a gauge symmetry which relates them. Because on the sphere, there are three global conformal transformations, which from the point of view of the plane, they correspond to translations, scaling transformations, and then a partner to translations, which are like translations if I invert z. I can use those three symmetries to move these 3 points wherever I want. I can move them at 0, 1, at infinity, or whatever. So if this is a gauge symmetry, it's a choice that should not be visible in the final answer. So the final answer of my calculation better be independent of z1, z2, and z3, because it was just a gauge choice. And I would like to verify this fact. So we have computed the Gauss contribution. We have computed the matter contribution. Let's put them together. So c bar e to the I p1x. C bar e to the I p2x, C bar e to the I p3x is the product of the two. So this pedestal is probably going to be in the way. I'm going to write it here. I have z1 minus z2 to the 2 p1 dot p2 plus 2. Z1 minus Z3, the 2P1 dot P3 plus 2. Z2 minus Z3, the 2P2 dot P3 plus 2. Now, here I lied for a moment, sorry. I forgot something. This correlation function is only non-zero if there is a momentum conservation. sorry, these are delta function normalizable things. So here I have delta p1 plus p2 plus p3. But if p1 is minus p2 minus p3, then p1 squared, which should be 2, is also p2 squared plus p3 squared plus 2p2p3. And so we learned that 2p2p3 plus 2 is 0. So this correlation function representing this string theory amplitude actually equals just the momentum conservation. And the dependence on the ZI drops out. And I really want to stress that, you know, this looks a bit miraculous, right? There was a conspiracy between the ghosts and the matter fields. How would I sort of explain this miracle in a concrete and practical manner? Well, I could do this. So I have these three operators, O1 and Z1, O2 and Z2, O3 and Z3. Each of these are Q-closed. I want to show that this is independent of, say, Z3. What I can do is to take the tree, a derivative respect to Z3. Okay. So now I'll have the tree O3. Now, this, if I take a derivative respect to Z, this actually implies that Q also kills the O of Z. But on the other hand, while this operator had some scaling dimension 1, this operator has scaling dimension 2. And we didn't compute systematically the cohomology of Q, but I told you that the cohomology of Q coincides with the physical states, which in particular have L0 equal to 1. So it must be the case that this one is not in cohomology, meaning that it's not just killed by Q, but it's also in the image of Q. And indeed, it's not difficult to find that dO of Z is actually the same as Q acting on bO, roughly. I mean B minus 1, or it's a bit messy. I should really go to states to make the statement correctly. So I go to DOZ, I write it as L minus 1 O state operator map. And then I write this as Q acting on B minus 1 of O. And then this B minus 1 of O will be something, I don't know which name to give it. OB, I don't know. But it has the property that if you add with Q on it, you get your derivative. So this is the same as correlation function of O1, O2, and Q on some OB. Now, Q is a symmetry. Being a symmetry means that if I that I can move it from one operator to the other ones. In conformal field theory, you could even sort of do it by hand in the sense that Q is defined as a little contour integral of the BRST current around one of the points, and you can deform it so that it wraps the other two. But anyway, this is the same as minus Q O1 O2 OB minus O1 Q O2 OB. But these are both zero because these are supposed to be in the cohomology. So the Bresci formalism guarantees that these had to be independent of the Z's.
Can I generalize this for higher point amplitudes as well?
Well, for higher point amplitude, yes, in a way, which now will look confusing, right? Because you would say, wait, but then what if I try to do this calculation? Right? And I write it as O1, O2, O3, O4. And then I take a derivative with respect to Z4, and I get zero. But actually, this is just zero to start with, because there are four C's. The point is, this is not what we're supposed to compute. So these surfaces have a one-dimensional space of compact structures. So we're supposed to produce a measure, something we can integrate over the space of compact structure. And we do so by having some extra insertions of B. So there are also going to be some Bs and B bars inserted in a specific way, which I could describe is a little complicated. We're going to use a trick to avoid doing so. But this is what I'm supposed to compute. And so if I try to use the same trick, I take a derivative and I manipulate like that, the Q, well, I get a piece where the Q acts on that. So instead of getting zero, I will get O1, O2, O3, OB, T, because Q acting on B gives me T. And an insertion of, right, so this is not zero. But if you integrate over the space of complex structures in a way we'll discuss momentarily, then here you get an integral like that. And you can show that this T insertion is a total derivative. And so if everything goes well, it integrates to zero. There are definitely exceptions to that. At loop or, you know, there are interesting Bresci anomalies, which come from the corners of integration or the integration space. I will discuss a little bit of those in the next lecture. But they have a very specific meaning. Yes.
Can you remember a bit why for this mean that the correlation function is zero?
Oh, yes, yes. So I mean for C's and no B. So if this theory has a Gauss number symmetry, normally that would mean that if I put operators that are charged, which have an overall positive charge, the correlation function vanishes. But here there is a little bit of a subtlety due to this Gauss number anomaly. So a way to explain this subtlety is the following. Suppose I take the sum, I try to write these. So how would I usually prove that this has to be zero, that something with total charge 4 must be zero? Let me do it for this first. Let me see. So usually, I would naively have said this is zero because it has total charge 3. How would I do that? I would say, well, if I sum something like that, I should get zero. J0C is just a shortcut. I just mean that the charge, the Gauss number charge, acting on C. You can think about this as sort of a little contour integral of the current around one of the points. And here I do another little contour integral. And here I do another little contour integral. So if I add them up, this is like a contour integral around all three points. Naively, I would just pull it at infinity and get zero. Sort of, I have my sphere, I have three points, I have my contour, I just pull it over and shrink it to nothing. But J Gauss is not a primary. So in order to pull it at infinity, let me say that this is infinity, I need to sort of deform it to something that goes around infinity. And then I need to do a calculation in that local coordinate system near infinity. So, but here I was, so I need to go from J of Z to somehow J of 1 over Z prime. The Jacobian of this transformation is 1 over Z squared. The logarithm is twice the logarithm of Z. I end up with something like 2 times this number times 1 over z. But then, if I integrate a little 1 over z, if I do a contour integral of 1 over z on a very large circle, I get 1. So this is not 0. This is a number times 2. C. Now, it just so happened that the number is 3/2. So number times 2 is 3. So if I have 3 ghosts, this is perfectly sensible. I have 3 times this equal to the sum of 3 things, which are also the same, because the ghost has charge 1. But if I have 4 ghosts, I'm getting an equality that tells me that 3 times CCCC equals to 4 times CCCC. And so CCCC must be 0.
Okay.
Very good. So how do I do this kind of integrals? This looks so painful. So there is a trick. The trick is pretty much to sort of, the trick is to somehow combine these B's with one of the operators. And what do I mean with that? So at the moment we have a gauge symmetry, which allows me to move to three points around. But the fourth one is a piece of non-trivial. So I have 3 degrees of freedom, 3 gauge freedoms, and 4 Zs, 4 positions. What I can do is to sort of use those 3 degrees of freedom to fix 3 of the positions to places I want, and use the fourth one to parameterize my model space of surfaces. If I do that, then this specific B insertion I need to insert depends only on the fourth position. It doesn't know anything about the other things. And there is a sort of a systematic way to combine it with all 4. Now, I'll tell you the answer to that. And then we'll try to think of why this answer is sensible. So I'll give you a recipe. So the recipe is the following. At the point Z, I, we are going to put C, C bar, or physical of ZI if we treat ZI as, if ZI is fixed. If it's one of the 3 points I fixed using my my gauge fixing. On the other hand, we just put the physical without the ghosts if And actually, maybe more precise, I want to integrate all the position of these things. So I'm going to put an actual measure, desi, desi bar. If zi is an integration variable, integrated over. Okay, why is this a reasonable choice? Well, this is definitely Beresty closed. It's good. This is not Beresty closed. I didn't put the C's. But if I do Q on my physical state alone, I get what? There is a term which gives me the derivative. So something like that. It's a gauge trans. This is supposed to be a gauge transformation with parameter C. So it's going to be C of Z, D of O physical of Z, because O physical is a primary. And so it transforms under diffeomorphisms in a very simple way. And I'm doing a diffeomorphism with parameter C. Actually, there is an extra term which is proportional to the scaling dimension of O physical. And if I combine them, I actually get this a bit better. So what's happening? I mean, it's pretty much the same equation we're writing over there. It's just that the thing I call b minus 1 of physical, b minus 1 of c of physical, is really the same as of physical. Remember, b minus 1 takes the ground state and maps it to the vacuum, takes c and maps it to the identity. So this is the same thing we were calling OB before. And so Q acting on this gives me a total derivative. So if I'm studying an integral over Z, I'm still getting something Q closed. So it looks sensible. So somehow, this thing here has been transformed in just O physical. So this question marks here turns out that what I needed to do here, if I just look very carefully, was just literally acting with b minus 1 and b minus 1 bar on this. And that removes two C's, and this is the physical thing. As I'm almost done with time, I will wax lyrically about some interesting concept instead of continuing the calculation. So the relation between this and this is called a descent relation. So there are a whole bunch of situations where you might find having some sort of a operator, which is Q closed, but the derivative of the operator. And when I say derivative, actually, I'm going to use the language of forms. The derivative operator is Q of something else. And then the derivative of the something else maybe is Q of something else. And it keeps going for a while until you get the top form. So here, this is O0, and this is O2, to be precise. And it's useful to combine them. Just write O0 plus O1 plus O2. This is an object looks a little bit unfamiliar, but when you work with forms, it's actually very natural to add forms of different degree. And then when you integrate them, you just pick the one that has the correct degree to be integrated. So a better way to think about this alternative is that they were just inserting O. And then we're deciding if to integrate, what to integrate over. So instead of doing this arbitrary choice, I integrate over this and not that or something, you can really just say I have O1 or O2 and so on. And I integrate them over some path. In my space of positions. And if the path is defined by saying, okay, I fix O2 and I integrate, or O1 and I integrate over O2, this definition will automatically pick these for Z1 and these for Z2. But this gives you a bit more freedom in deciding how you gauge fixing your thing. It's sort of a gauge fixing independent way of talking about it. As long as you pick some representative of this space modulo SL2C, this will give you the right answer. So it sort of automatically includes all of these manipulations that you use to show that the choices don't matter. So I'm mentioning it because sometimes this formalism is useful when you talk about anomalies. So you might encounter this in other places in theoretical physics. So I want to mention it.
Mm-hmm. Can I make, for example, two operators move if I insert two bigos like instead of one?
Well, the number of bigos depends on the number of operators you have. But if you want to study something which has five points, then you will definitely need two of the points to move. And you insert two b's. And so you use three fixed and two movable operators. So what we're going to do next lecture, if I remember correctly, well, first I want to look at a few more three-point functions. Here we just put tachyons. I want to look at what happens if I put gravitons. And then we can try to do a four-point function. Okay, so see you next week. And as usual, office hours on Monday. Happy to answer any questions.